Welcome to Tribecast. I'm Forrest Walden, founder and CEO of Iron Tribe Fitness. And on this podcast, I am going to help you find your tribe and maximize your life. Welcome to another episode of Tribecast. Super excited this morning to have a guest, Cliff Sims, author of the book Team of Vipers, My 500 Extraordinary Days in the White House. Cliff, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Cliff, you are a Birmingham guy. You started here before you went to D.C. So a lot of people in our listening audience will know you, but most won't. So talk about just a little bit about who you are and eventually how you got to the White House. But just start with who Cliff is.
Yeah. So son of a Baptist minister, grew up in the South playing basketball. That was my first love. Wanted to play in the NBA. Can't see me because it's a podcast, but I'm 5'9". So it was not meant to be.
Not in the cards.
But I did play in college and then had this bizarre few years where I dropped out of school and toured around the country playing music. Had songs on MTV and the radio and major motion pictures and had a crazy wild ride for a few years there. Met a girl in that process who's now my wife. Didn't want to be on the road for 250 days a year. And buddy of mine decided to run for the House of Representatives in Alabama. He was my Sunday school teacher and actually the first investor in our band. And he said, I know you're looking for what you're going to do next. I don't know what I'm doing in politics. And I know you don't know what you're doing, but why don't you come down here and help me run this campaign? And that was in 2009.
And who was that?
Barry Moore was his name. And it was a big year in Alabama because Republicans took over the legislature for the first time in 136 years. And so a lot of the people that were swept into power, I got to know really well through that process. And so decided to go back to school, went to Alabama, and wanted to figure out a way to use these relationships that I had built and kind of got bit by the political bug a little bit. And so I started a blog called Yellowhammer Politics, at the time Yellowhammer being the state bird of Alabama. And just to kind of tell behind the scenes of what was going on in Montgomery and also to provide kind of a more conservative perspective on politics here in Alabama. And the thing just kind of blew up. And so it kind of moved from being my blog to a full-blown news outlet called Yellowhammer News. And millions of monthly visitors and 30 radio stations around the state. And through that, got to know a guy named Jeff Sessions, who was our senator at the time. And it was a 2016 election cycle by then. And he convinced me to take a leave of absence and go join the Trump campaign in New York City. And so rode that crazy train for a few months. And lo and behold, we won, which is one of those moments where you're like, this is amazing. And oh, my God, what did we do all at the same time? And so then got asked to come in and work in the White House. And so I was the title was Special Assistant to the President and Director of White House Message Strategy, which is basically a fancy title for all things communications related, except for the tweets. He's doing the tweets. I didn't have anything to do with the tweets. So did that for 500 days, left there, wrote the memoir that you mentioned about that, spent a few weeks on the New York Times list with that, and now I'm back here in Birmingham as the president of a company called Telegraph Creative. It's a branding agency, so we do branding, digital marketing, full-service creative agency, and then we also have a tech side of the company. We build software applications and things like that. So yeah, back in Birmingham and glad to be here. Long-time triber, too.
Yes, you are, and I'm glad you're back myself, and there's so much we could unpack. I mean, reading the book, watching some interviews you've done, just knowing the breadth and depth of what's happened in your life the last 2 years, there's got to be so many lessons. But I actually want to go pre-White House. One thing that was really impactful to me reading the book is in leading, you're CEO of Yellowhammer, you're growing this digital marketing radio platform, and the Governor Bentley story breaks, and you were a big part of that. And so you were not immune to criticism, to issues in the news that were polarizing, where you were taking strong stances on them before you got to the White House. And I can even confess, as an advertiser on your show, I actually got phone calls of people like land blasting me for even being on your show. Yeah. So if me, just a vendor advertiser, was getting hate mail, I'm assuming you're no stranger to that before you even get on the Trump train.
Yeah, and part of that I think is a function of where we're at right now as a country in terms of our political discourse, that there is not a lot of room for nuance. There's not a lot of room for others' perspectives. And as consumers of news, a lot of us at this point are really, we go to the places that that reaffirm our worldview rather than challenge our worldview. And so for those who are maybe listening to my radio show who were more liberal, leaning their political perspectives, there's a lot of anger that kind of, you know, is very divisive. And frankly, sometimes when you're in the media business right now, you are actually incentivized to stoke that. Because that drives conversation, drives attention. And so it's hard not to get kind of lost in that when you're in the news business a little bit. And so it doesn't surprise me that you got calls on that. I got, you know, I remember one morning I woke up and there were protesters outside my house. And so, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, becomes part of it. And it, the most difficult thing for me in that was the more people who know who you are but don't know you, the more difficult time you have with this feeling inside of you that you want to be, every one of us wants to be understood, right? So my motives are pure. I sincerely believe the things I'm saying. I'm not being paid by the Koch brothers to say these things, you know, whatever it may be. And having to come to terms with criticism, that anything that you do in life that is of significance and real substance and perhaps challenges the status quo in some way or another, you're going to get criticized for it. And in a lot of ways, your ability to achieve what you're trying to do in whatever space it may be is going to be directly commensurate with the amount of criticism that you are willing to endure to get there. And so I got that on a very small scale working at Yellowhammer, and then on the biggest possible scale at the White House, and then with the book after that.
Yeah, and that's a lesson we've actually talked about throughout the show, is anytime you're trying to create anything of significance, you're going to experience praise and people who come behind you. And yeah, I love what you're doing. I'm a big fan. And you're going to experience persecution.
Yeah.
And you have to be prepared for both. And if you're not prepared for persecution, it will literally keep you from creating big things in your life,
because
you can't handle the kickback.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I want to start with body. So the show is all about body, being balance, and business. You were a college athlete, longtime triber, as you've said. So you've been at 280, I think, since we opened that gym, which
was
8 years ago. I'm really curious, as you moved into the White House and it became all-consuming, and that's one of the things I took away from the book, is you can lose yourself in the machine of politics. Were you able to keep any kind of fitness program? There's a few things you talk about, jogging a few times. I wonder, did that go by the wayside, or were you able to keep your fitness
I was program going? It went in a little bit of cycles depending on what was going on in the White House. I mean, the thing about working in the White House is you just kind of never know when you wake up what direction that day is going to go. But for the most part, I tried to stay on a pretty healthy routine, healthy schedule, and that did not include getting up in the morning and doing it, because you just, you know, you never know when you're going to get a phone call at 4:30 in the morning. You got to go in or whatever. The mornings were just much more difficult. And so what I normally did was, when I left the White House in the evenings, the first thing I did, I lived a block from the White House. And so I would run down 15th Street there in New York, or in D.C., toward the Washington Monument. I would cross over the National Mall and go up to the southwest side of the city. And there was an outdoor gym there that I just came across on a total fluke. And one really cool thing about it is, one day I was actually, they had this kind of sign, metal sign there, that you could kick up onto to do handstand push-ups. And so I kick up onto the sign and I kind of fall back down, and I'm taking a break in between sets, and I look up, and at the bottom of the little metal sheet, it said, "Made in Alabama."
Ha!
And it was just this crazy, like, that became like my little piece of home there. And so I would say probably 5 days a week, I would run. It was about a mile and a half to get there. And I would jog over there, do a, you know, whatever you know, workout of the day was. I still had the Iron Tribe app that I would kind of flip through, and then I would jog back. And so most days, that was kind of the one time of the day, the one probably hour and 15 minutes of the day that I was not totally wired into the news, constantly getting alerts on my phone of what was happening. So that was kind of like a really important cathartic experience every day. And so I was able to stay pretty consistent in that while I was there.
Okay, now that you're back in Birmingham, we got you plugged back into the gym.
Yeah, I'm getting back plugged in. I'm nursing a little bit of a shoulder injury, but yeah, I'm back in there and trying to get it back rolling.
Perfect. I know one of the hot topics around Trump is – his fitness. mental fitness and physical fitness at his age.
Yeah.
Is he fit for the presidency? Does he have any kind of workout routine?
No,
whatsoever?
You know, he has this belief that your body is essentially like a battery, that if you use energy doing anything, working out or whatever it may be, that it just depletes itself. Now, I think we know that that's not a correct way to look at it, that if you work out, it actually recharges your battery, you know, it provides more stamina and that kind of thing. So, no, he doesn't have a workout regimen. In fact, somebody asked him about that, and he made this comment. He said, you know, people don't know. I do a lot more than they realize. I walk here. I walk there. Sometimes I walk to the building across the street over there and back. And I was sitting there thinking, I've walked with him to the building across the street, the Eisenhower building. I think every time he's ever done it, it's only been a handful of times. And he was using that kind of as examples of working out. He plays golf, as you know. But, you know, it's really bizarre because one thing about Trump that I think lives up to the hype is actually this idea that he's just got this crazy amount of stamina, mm-hmm. and he just works all the time. And he only sleeps a few hours a night. He eats cheeseburgers and well-done steak and kind of all those things that we've kind of heard about the way he lives are all true, and yet he's still able to go 20 hours a day. It's bizarre, man.
That is bizarre, especially at his age.
Yeah, no question.
And, you know, you talk about him saying the whole battery thing. It kind of fits his whole philosophy on life, which everything's a zero-sum game.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, doesn't That's right. even That's fit right. in there?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's shift over to balance. You briefly mentioned it, but you've been married for 8 years mm-hmm. to your wife, Megan.
Yeah.
And you guys are in the process of adoption?
Yeah, Talk we're to me about that. Adopting from Colombia. And, you know, this has been a long journey for us. My wife struggled with infertility some, but it was kind of one of those things where the doctor couldn't say, here's a specific reason why this is happening, or you can't have children or anything like that. And so, you know, Lord willing, we'll still have biological children at some point. And my wife was very, she was very vulnerable about this in our conversations where I think anyone, as you have, has gone through this adoption journey. There are questions that you have inside of you that you feel uncomfortable articulating because you feel like it makes you a bad person. You know, I'll just say by way of an example, you have to fill out these health sheets on like, will you take a child with this health issue or that health issue? And then when you mark no on some of those things, it makes you feel like, oh my gosh, I'm a bad, how could I not accept any child?
And if I don't accept them, who is?
Right. So it's these things that you wrestle with. But one of those was, will I love my adopted child the way that I love, as much as I love a biological child? And if my wife was being very honest, she said, I was not sure about that. And the Lord really took her on a journey that included a trip to Ethiopia, and where they worked in orphanages there, and broke her heart for those kids. And she sees them and realizes, like, oh my gosh, yes, I will. There's no question, I will love our adopted child just as much as I would love a biological child. It was just a journey that God had to take her on in that. And you know, we are members of Church of Brook Hills here in Birmingham, and so we kind of came up under a teaching about adoption and our views on adoption. And we always kind of felt like adoption would be a part of what, you know, our story, but maybe we'd have a biological child first. And what we've realized through all of this is adoption is not second best. It is an incredible picture of what Christ has done for us. And so for us to be able to walk that journey together has been really cool. And so probably first quarter of next year, we'll have a little Colombian baby in our home somewhere between the ages of 0 and 3. We don't know boy or girl yet, but we're walking through that.
So
right
waiting
now.
On the referral.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
So 2 weeks ago, I had Mindy on, and we went through my wife, and we went through the whole adoption journey and talked about some of these very same issues you're bringing up. And we really didn't know. And Mindy told it in her own words, when I see him for the first time, am I going to feel the way about him mm-hmm. that I felt about my biological kids? And emphatically, 100% yes, it's beautiful. And so excited that you're on that journey.
Yeah.
Okay, going to shift a little bit. And to me, this is so cool because you said on an interview, you know, we're all watching this movie play out, but we all have completely different interpretations about what we're seeing, right? Everything is so polarized.
Mm-hmm.
And what I appreciated about the book is I felt like you did a great job of being very balanced and saying, here's some things that are good and here's some things that are completely dysfunctional. Oh, and by the way, here's some ways that I got pulled into this whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you were very transparent about, I'm not innocent here, right? And so what I'd love to talk about is, as you've entered the White House, as you went through that process, and now you've exited, just talk about the role of you as the son of a Baptist preacher, sitting under David Platt, which I've talked a lot about on this podcast, mm-hmm. hope to have him on soon, in D.C., now at McLean. He was your pastor there. We have that in common. Yeah. I grew up under Platt. How your faith formed your experience at the White House, and just maybe some of the struggles that existed because of that.
Yeah, man. Wow. There's a lot of directions that I could go with that. But, you know, I underestimated the value of, well, for us here in Birmingham, there's a group of people in our church small group who, for me, didn't give a hoot what I did for a living, didn't care about any of this. So they cared about, you know, my relationship with Christ and that being around people that influence each other in that way, a support system, I guess, for lack of a better word. Losing that and going to D.C., I totally underestimated the kind of shock to the system that would be for me. And so Washington, D.C. is a dark place, man. It is a very difficult place to live and to work. And that's not to say that there aren't very good people there and they're not sincere, you know, Bible-believing Christians there who are living out their lives in that context. But it's just tough. And the Trump White House, I think, in particular, because of the environment, the work environment that was created there, that was really a dog-eat-dog kind of situation. And look, I like healthy competition, yeah, even in the workplace. It can be a great thing. It can get the best out of people. But there was an extra layer on top of that in the Trump White House that, look, there's a reason the book is called Team of Vipers, right? You know, it's a very tough environment. And a lot of times there was a lot of backstabbing and people going after each other inside of there. And it doesn't take long for, if you don't have a healthy check on that, to lose yourself in it. And there were definitely times when I did, and the reason was that it's very easy for any of us who are really ambitious. I think those of us who are entrepreneurs kind of have this gene in us. We're competitive by nature. We're ambitious. We want to go. It's easy to lose yourself and allow your identity but to become what you do for a living, what your job is. Mm-hmm. And DC especially, because everything is status. You know, what elected office you hold or what elected office holder you work for, what your, you know, rank is in the pecking order, how much access you have to the president of the United States, you know, those kind of things. And it becomes all consuming. And you forget that our identity is not in what we do for a living. It's in who we are in Christ. And that's where I kind of lost myself.
So on that identity subject, I loved you're on CNN. You're being interviewed about the book and Trump tweets about you.
Yeah.
And your response was amazing. So talk to me about that
situation. Yeah. You know, I was sitting there on set of CNN New Day, and the president tweeted something to the effect of, you know, Cliff Sims was a nobody. He was a gopher. And he is a mess. And, you know, whatever, something like that. And I know I should have prepared for this to happen, but I actually didn't. It's really straight. Like, I did mock interviews. I did a ton of preparation on how I'll answer certain questions. The question I did not prepare for was, like, I'm literally sitting there and the president tweets while I'm on air and I'm having to respond in real time to that. So,
well, they do a split screen. She's reading the tweet and your face is on the other side. So you're hearing it live, yes, with the rest of the audience.
Yes. And for some reason, though, just had this overwhelming sense of peace in that moment. My heart was not beating fast. I wasn't nervous about it. And just the first thing that came to mind for me was, that's okay, because my identity is not in who Donald Trump says I am or who anybody else says I am. It's in who Jesus says that I am, and he says that I'm one of his. And so, that was I prayed leading up to all of those interviews that whatever happened, that something that I did or said that would be used to glorify Christ through what was happening. And I hope that
he was glorified in that moment, even if there are a bunch of other moments in the book where he was not glorified through my actions.
I don't think she exactly knew where to go after you responded that way. It was great. So I want to take you to a couple places in the book that just really jumped out at me. And one of them is you spend a whole chapter on the mooch is loose about Scaramucci. And I think most people know that story. And if not, I strongly urge you to read the book. It's just, it'll connect so many dots for you as we've all seen these sound bites, but to hear it firsthand. So he comes in and out of administration in 11 days.
Yeah.
And really was kind of a microcosm of the pursuit of power and losing himself in this new role and fighting for the president and showing him he was loyal. Gets kicked out after 11 days. And you write in the book that he gave you the best advice that you received. And what he said was, none of this matters if it costs you what really matters. So tell me about that and what he was talking about and why it impacted you so deeply.
Yeah, so early on in the White House, there was a pretty significant power struggle between several factions. There was kind of the Republican National Committee staffers who had come into the White House, many of whom had kind of bailed on Trump during the campaign, only to then find themselves working in senior roles for him in the White House. Then there was kind of the Steve Bannon faction of kind of populist nationalist type folks ideologically. And then there was kind of this Jared Kushner family group there. And so I kind of bounced between, you know, close to Jared Kushner, close to Steve Bannon, tried to sit out their little squabbles between each other. But the Republican National Committee folks and I just really didn't get along very well. And so Sean Spicer, the press secretary at the time, I kind of maneuvered to try to push him out. And part of that was to bring Scaramucci in. And Jared Kushner was working on that as well. And, you know, Reince Priebus, who was the chief of staff at the time, had done everything he could to block Scaramucci from coming into the White House because Scaramucci had a great relationship with the president. He did not want to create yet another power center there that could kind of undermine his authority. And so they had blocked him from coming into that point. And this really frustrated Scaramucci, who talking about ambition, I mean, raw, unbridled ambition, just like rip your head off to get to the top kind of ambition. And eventually, we work it out where he's able to come in, and this sets off a few days of just mass chaos, of just him versus Reince, and it's playing out some in the media. It's just a wild, wild few days there. And in all of this happening, Scaramucci's wife has a child, and he doesn't even go home to see his child be born. She filed for divorce from him. And he didn't, you know, frankly, in that moment, probably didn't really care that much and was like, you know, I have made it to the top of the mountain. I am a senior advisor to the president of the United States. I have unfettered access to the Oval Office, the most powerful man in the world. And he was, you know, I had a buddy of mine who was a pollster, said that Scaramucci's name ID nationwide went from 0 to 50% in 1 week. I mean, that is an unimaginable amount of fame that happened just
like
that.
Well, you talk about in the book, you walked by two homeless men and they were talking about
Scaramucci. They're arguing over Scaramucci. They don't even have a television. They don't have anything, but they're arguing over Scaramucci. I mean, that's the level of notoriety fame that this guy got, and he was drunk on it. And, you know, he blew himself up. In 11 days, he had this crazy moment with a reporter where this kind of profanity-laden interview he didn't realize was on the record ends up getting out, and he ends up getting himself fired when John Kelly comes in to replace Reince Priebus as chief of staff. And a couple of months goes by, and you know, I was very close to Scaramucci because we worked, our desks were 10 feet from each other. I helped orchestrate him coming in. And in some ways, Scaramucci gets a bad rap. He's actually a very smart guy. If he could have gotten past this kind of first, you know, being drunk, intoxicated with the media attention, it probably would have been a good thing for the president in any way. But
you know, several months goes by after he leaves, and we have breakfast, and he has kind of had this, what he referred to as a, like he was visited by the three ghosts, like the Christmas story or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he said, I've got a new lease on life. He said, I realized that I had lost myself in it. And, you know, I almost lost my family. He almost lost his business, which he had like a massive nine-figure hedge fund that he controlled. And he said, the quote that you read, which is he gave me the best advice I got the whole time was there, is that none of this matters if you lose what really matters. And that was in that moment, especially when he told me that, and he didn't even know what was going on inside at that point, was kind of like a punch in the face to me. Because it wasn't like I was about to lose my marriage. Megan and I were great, and she was, you know, our relationship was good through that period. But I had definitely lost perspective on what actually mattered. It didn't cross my mind one second, what impact can I have on these people that I work with every day? It was all about how can I maneuver? How can I move these pieces on the chessboard that I can get, you know, maintain my access to power and squash my enemies? Mm-hmm. That was basically the perspective I have. And so, yeah, it's a crazy, people would never imagine that Anthony Scaramucci would give me the best advice I got the whole time I was in there, but he did.
Well, and the reason that jumped out at me is it's really what this whole show is all about. Who cares if you make it to the work for the president of the United States, if you lose your body, if you lose the relationships that are closest to you, if you lose your connection with God and drift, or if I build the biggest iron job business with thousands of franchisees, what ultimately matters in the end? And so I'm going to segue.
Well, I want to say one more thing on that, if I can. At the end of the book, in the afterword, like the last chapter of the book, I talk about this with Trump. That I was studying for this book, and kind of this whole concept we're talking about, I found some research that a woman who was a hospice care nurse had done research on the regrets of the dying. And the most common regret was that they had spent too much time on the treadmill of work and they had they didn't have those relationships, that no one on their deathbed thinks, oh, my gosh, if I could have opened up one more franchise. But they do say, if I could just have one more week with my family, you know, those are the things, those relationships. And so even with Trump, one of the things that I felt like I noticed in interacting with him in the White House is that the high of being elected president was never reached again by being president. Mm. And so he's in this constant pursuit of that high. And I wonder, in the last chapter of the book, will Trump have this same reaction the day when he's sitting on his deathbed? Will it be enough that he was the most famous, most powerful person in this, in maybe in human history, arguably? There's some data that supports that, at least in terms of the number of people who know who he is. Or will he, too, wish that he had spent more time on those relationships? Mm-hmm. And we'll never know with him, but I know that answer for me.
Yes. Okay, this may put a period on this discussion, or you may add another thing from this quote, but it really jumped out at me on page 194, your greatest regret. My greatest regret from my time in the White House is that I wasn't a better picture of my faith to the president and my colleagues. I'm haunted by the late author Brennan Manning's quote, "The greatest single cause of atheism in the world today is Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips and then walk out the door and deny him by their lifestyle. This is what an unbelieving world simply finds unbelievable." So does that put a period to this, or is there anything you would add?
I don't know if I could add anything to that. That sums it up exactly.
And it's not like you completely lost your way, right? It's really, so looking back now as you're out, what would you have done differently? Did you ever have any conversations with Trump about his faith? Did that ever come up?
Well, I don't think it will come as any surprise to anyone that Donald Trump is not a believer. Mm-hmm. Somebody said, and I think this really sums up how I view him as well, he is not a great picture of the Christian faith, but he has been a great defender. Mm-hmm. From a policy perspective, right. Some of the things that he's done, I think, have been great. But there are numerous stories in the book. The one that sticks out the most is there's a moment where Trump is really frustrated because he's reading these stories in the news in which he's being criticized by anonymous White House officials. So people that work for him are trashing him without putting their name on it. And he's like, who the heck are these people? And so he brings me in there into the private study just off of the Oval Office. There's a suite of rooms. There's a bathroom that he loves to kind of show off because it's white marble and it's really nice. And there's a little private study there, which he used to say, you know, this is where Bill and Monica, you know what happened here. And then there's a private dining room right off of there that has a big flat screen TV where he spends most of his time in there. Anyway, he brings me into the private study and he says, "Who are these people?" And in that moment, I proceeded to lay out person by person who I thought it was. And I didn't lie. I told him what I sincerely believed. But as I got back to my desk, there was this kind of moment of almost guilt that I had, that I had just, you know, stabbed my colleagues in the back. And there was really no honor in doing that. And that was one of those moments where I did kind of feel like, wow, this, I have kind of lost myself in this. But if I had it to do over again, it's not that I would have walked around the office, you know, evangelizing, so to speak, like constantly throwing out Bible verses and, you know, whatever. It's really more, you can say more in your actions and the way that you act. And I had an opportunity to be such a, hey, there's something different about that guy mm-hmm. than the rest of the people here, rather than being just like everybody else. And that's what I would have done differently, is respond to some of those situations differently than I did. I was, you know, I saw a lot of interactions between Trump and his so-called faith advisory committee. And it's one of the things that frustrated me the most, is these are people who, you know, they're faith leaders. They're pastors, a lot of them, and they have unbelievable access to the president of the United States, and basically never saw them use that to advance anything other than their own proximity to power too. So even the, like, ministers weren't immune to the same kind of thing. And so, yeah, I would have done so much different.
Okay. Well, it's easy to glance over that for me as a listener and a reader, but I really thought about that situation and put myself in your shoes. I mean, here you are, you're pulled into Trump's like inner circle. He doesn't bring many people back to that inner office. And he's asking your opinion, mm-hmm. which means you've earned credibility with him. And you say in the book, you know you have, because he started asking you, hey, Cliff, what did you think about that video shot, right?
Yeah.
And that's like his most important thing, is his image. And so you gain credibility, even though he tries to call you a videographer and a gopher.
Right.
But reading the book, it's clear, like, you had some really close access and influence on what was going on. So in that moment, I'm thinking, you've got to be kind of overwhelmed with, my gosh, he's asking me my opinion on a very sensitive mm-hmm. subject, and I'm happy to give him the dirt, because, man, this elevates my status. So anyway, I just spent some time thinking about that, and I could see how, man, I would have been in the same situation.
Well, but you know what I forgot was, I think a lot of us who are Christians, who have, we have unfettered access to the creator of the entire universe. Mm. And so, yes, I was caught up in the fact that I'm sitting here with an arm's length and a closed door. No one else is here, with the most powerful human on earth. This man has the ability to wipe countries off the face of the planet with one snap of his fingers. And you are not as awed by that when you are awed by the fact that at any moment of the day, you can talk to someone, you know, who's more powerful than everybody on the planet combined, you know, the creator of everything. And that's, again, where you, if you don't have a proper perspective on, you know, what really matters, that it's easy to get sucked into moments like that and be overwhelmed by that moment.
Well said. Very well said. A couple quotes I just want to recap and get you to unpack for us a little bit. You touched on it. You said it was the single most toxic working environment that you've ever experienced. And I know now, as the CEO of Telegraph, we'll talk about that at the end. That's certainly not something you'd want to replicate. I'm mm-hmm. sure you're trying to build a great culture with team members who are excited to be there. If it wasn't your access to Trump, it sounds like it was a pretty miserable environment.
Yeah, I kind of, yes, definitely. I mean, It's tough to explain until you see it, but I'm sure that the White House is always a difficult place to work. The hours are long. The issues are extremely weighty, sometimes including life and death certainly including, you know, policies that impact every American in some way or another, your pocketbook or, your, you know, whatever it may be. And so that's tough as it is, but you layer on top of that the cutthroat atmosphere that he cultivated and these different factions. And, you know, a lot of it's leadership on these things starts at the very top. So, you know, as the CEO of Iron Tribe, your DNA is infused throughout what happens across the company. And so it's the same with Trump. His DNA and the way he operates is infused throughout the West Wing. And a lot of that is this kind of creative chaos that I think he gets unjustly criticized for sometimes because he doesn't like a lot of structure. He likes to be creative and leave a lot of unstructured time where he can think outside the box and just kind of freewheel and go with it. And some of that, I think, is healthy. And I also think the thing he doesn't get credit for enough is that he brought, you know, normally in a White House, everyone there is pretty much on the same page ideologically. He brought in people that are incredibly diverse ideologically, especially like take an issue like trade. You've got Gary Cohn, who was the president of Goldman Sachs, who comes in to be his chief economic advisor. He is an avowed free trader, you know, doesn't want any trade restriction. Then you got Peter Navarro, who ran the National Trade Council, who wants to slap a tariff on everything that moves. So it's like you could not have two people more ideologically diverse. So he brings us two people in a room. They argue it out. I think you've got an opportunity here to have a better outcome because you're hearing diverse perspectives. The problem was when the president would make a decision after hearing those arguments, instead of walking out and everyone saying, I'm going to subordinate my views to the president and I'm going to get on board, or you also could quit anytime you want to. If you don't agree that much, you can also quit. Instead, what they would do is they would go out and try to, you know, leak it to the press to try to get the president to change his mind, or they would undermine or slow walk his decision. It just created this constant frustration where the president's directives are not being executed on and everyone's trying to leak things against each other and stab each other. And it just created this environment that was just, I never thought that I would dread waking up in the morning and going to work in the West Wing. Mm. You know, there's only 40 of us in the building. You know, it's a very, very small working environment. And what an honor. And there were definitely days where I woke up and was like, I don't want to go in there today. And so, yeah, I think about that now as I try to infuse Telegraph's culture with my DNA. There's already a great culture there and the people love working together. And it's just a reminder that, you know, work is such an incredible part of our lives because we're gonna spend about half of our waking hours at work. And so what an opportunity there. You know, if you I'm kind of like Steve Jobs on this. If you wake up too many days in a row and you don't want to go to work, you need to figure out something else to do. That's because right. That ain't worth it, man. You spend too much time doing it. And so, yeah, I think a lot about that now.
Okay, before I ask you about this next quote, you give us your best or one of your favorite just Trump stories in general.
Oh, gosh, man, there's so many. I love when foreign leaders would come into the White House, I mean, one of the coolest things about working there is from meeting to meeting, you're going from like, you know, Jeff Bezos and Tim Cook to, you know, the king of Jordan to, I mean, just the people that you get to be around, see it, how it works at the very, very highest levels.
Nick Saban.
Great example. I need to tell that Nick Saban story. He had some of the best advice of the whole time I was there, too. But one of my favorite Trump stories is when foreign leaders would come in, he'd get really excited, especially if, you know, if Obama and the foreign leader didn't get along very well, because he's like, you know, I'm going to make you my guy. He's going to love me. And so the president of Egypt, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, comes to the White House, and Trump is very excited about that for that exact reason. And I had spent a good bit of time in Egypt, and so I was like trying to brush up on my Arabic, and I'm going to talk to the, you know, president of Egypt, and it's going to be really cool. And so we're waiting in the cabinet room. Our delegation is on one side of the table. The Egyptian delegation is on the other side. Trump and el-Sisi come in together. They sit on opposite sides of the table, right in the middle. And Trump wants to start it off by introducing everybody.
And so he says, it's like, it was kind of like if the Chicago Bulls in 96, like the lights go dim, the music comes on, and he starts introducing people. And he's really proud of his cabinet. So he starts to come, he said, you know, this is Rex Tillerson. He ran a little company called Exxon Mobil. You might have heard of it. Also known as the largest company in the world. It's like, this is James Mad Dog Mattis. He's never lost a battle. You know what I'm talking about, General. He's never lost a battle. And he's going around the table, and he finally gets to the last one. He says, Gary Cohn, you know, he paid $400 million in taxes just to take this job to come here. And he said, and this is my Wilbur. All right, so Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, he kind of puts his hand on his hand. He said, Wilbur is so famous on Wall Street that you don't even have to say his last name. You just say Wilbur. And everyone knows who you're talking about. And Wilbur Ross is like this 85-year-old, you know, very sleepy-looking guy, very mild-mannered. And so Trump says, he says, you know why Wilbur's so good? He said, because he is a complete and total killer. Now, I'm listening in my headphones because the woman is trans. There's a woman translating from English to Arabic. So there's a little pause between he says something, they say, then they react. The word for killer in Arabic is essentially, it's murderer. So Trump says to the president of Egypt, I only hire murderers. and the poor woman translating like pauses for a second and she says that and then they react. They bust out laughing and Trump's like, you know what I'm talking about? And he's like, you know, thumbs up, like, yes, this guy's obviously been accused of all kinds of human rights abuses over there and kills people. And so the president of Egypt went back to Egypt thinking the president of the United States only hires murderers to work. Wow. And it was absolutely hysterical.
That is awesome. let's talk about the Nick Saban thing. Even though I'm a big Auburn guy, I'll give you a platform to talk about Alabama. What was that experience like?
Yeah, so Saban comes in and a small group from the university, the university president and the athletic director, Miss Terry, Nick Saban's wife, and Coach Saban were kind of waiting in the Roosevelt room.
Well, and they're there because of the national championship.
Won the national championship the year before. And so this was like a great day for the handful of Alabama people that were in the West Wing. It was just like really cool. And so I'm talking to Coach Saban, just kind of take advantage of this opportunity. And the deputy national security advisor walks by and sees them in there. And he comes in the door. And he's like, Coach Saban, I got to ask you a question. He said, you know, there's been a lot of college coaches who've had success. You know, you win a national championship here or there, win some conference championships here or there. But for some reason, you have been able to have consistent success year after year after year. What do you do that is different from anybody else? And Coach Saban was kind of like, you know, real sheepish. Like, well, I don't know. I don't know what other people do and that kind of thing. And then he kind of, you know, perked up and he said, you know what, though? When I was working under Bill Belichick, the one thing that I learned was that every person in the organization at the Patriots, from the head coach, the star quarterback, all the way down to the water boy, had clearly defined roles, goals, and responsibilities. And every single day they were held accountable for those things. And he said, I have applied that at Alabama. Every single person has a clearly defined role. They have clearly defined goals. Have clearly defined responsibilities, and I spend every waking hour holding everyone in this organization, including myself, accountable for every one of those things. And I said, that sounds like the exact opposite of what we've got going here. And he said, well, that's okay. You can learn from that too. And so that was just, man, in a nutshell, if you're leading an organization, what could be more powerful and important than just that microcosm of what has to happen in your organization every day? Everyone there's got to have a clearly defined role. They've got to have clearly defined goals. They got to know where we're going, and they've got to be held accountable for those things every single day. If you can just do that, you have an unbelievable organization, unbelievable workplace culture, and produce unbelievable results. But it's easier said than done, obviously. But that was just a great lesson from Nick Saban.
And a dichotomy of what you experienced.
Yes.
Reading the book, it was like, what was my role? Really, anything Trump wanted me to do day or that hour.
That's right.
I could be doing a bunch of different things. I didn't fit into a little neat org chart.
That's right.
All right, so here's the quote that we're building up to. Appreciate those stories. You said Trump could be a good president, even a great president, still, after all that you've seen. Mm-hmm. But what if he was a better man? What could be accomplished for the good of the world, really? Talk to me about that.
Yeah, you know, there's a scene in the book where the president has decided to move the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This is a big, big deal because president after president, going all the way back to at least Clinton, maybe the first Bush, maybe even Reagan, had promised to do this. And then they got scared once they got in the office and said, you know, the implications of this in the Middle East could be profound. And I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
And Trump said, but I promised I was going to do it. And he just did it. And I remember thinking like, man, first of all, what stones this guy has. And I'll say he is willing to endure any amount of criticism if he believes what he's doing is the right thing. What I could never entirely ascertain was, though, how he decided what is the right thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where kind of like the moral compass, like what makes you, what is Trump's moral compass? I don't know. But if he believes something's right, he'll endure anything. So he moves the embassy. And we go over to the White House residence on the ground floor in the diplomatic reception room. He makes this announcement to the world. We walk back over to the West Wing, and we're standing just outside the Oval Office, and there's a TV on the wall, and he looks up and he sees the TV coverage. And it looks like the Middle East is on fire. I mean, it's just people protesting. They're hanging him in effigy. They're shooting his picture. They're lighting American flags and his and posters of his face on fire. Just the most anger and vitriol that you could possibly imagine. And I felt in that moment kind of the same way that I feel if I'm walking down the street and I see someone stumble. I'm inclined to look away because when they look around to see if anybody saw him, I don't want to be embarrassed. Right. So like, just like, I didn't even see that happen, you know? And so I felt kind of embarrassed, like I was watching somebody stumble on this grand scale. And I'll never forget Trump's reaction, and maybe it's anticlimactic, but he said, what's next? Well, he asked, how widespread is this? And I said, well, I don't really know. You know, they pick the hot spots and they show that. And then he said, he kind of shrugs. He said, well, what's next? Like, what's next on the schedule today?
Mm.
And to be able to, I mean, it's easy to say, like, I'm going to let criticism roll off my back like water off a duck's back. And then to do it on that level, my gosh, I can't even imagine what that must have felt like. But he just kind of went on to the next thing. And that's why I say he's willing to endure just unbelievable criticism. But if he had a little bit more finely tuned moral compass with a center or a true north, then imagine what he could do and that what anybody could do in that office. And I found that, you know, power or access to power, the more power you get, the more I think that your moral compass is skewed. Because even for those of us who are Christians, if Christ is our true north, we start getting power, it's almost like we're getting closer to a magnetic pole. And that power starts moving our compass. It no longer just points true north because of that. And it's, you know, it's not just in, not just hard power, not military power, not the president of the United States kind of power, but your power over your employees or your ability to manipulate other people in your life to your, you know, what you want. I mean, power is, you know, it manifests itself. Money, yes, money. It manifests itself in different ways. And those things kind of warp our compass. And anybody, no matter how strong of a Christian they are, that can happen to them. And I just couldn't help but ask myself, someone with, frankly, that big of stones, if they had a true north, my gosh, the Imagine impact that they could have on the impact they have on the world.
Awesome. Okay, so my contention on this show, and I've said it 100 times, being what I call weaponized across body, being, and balance. Mm-hmm. Literally gives you the energy to build huge things in your life through business. And I have seen a lot of men, particularly as they build, lose the focus on some of those core principles. I mentioned the body, mm-hmm. they lose their health. The balance, they lose their relationships and they're on multiple marriages. Being, they completely lose their connection with God as that pull to power and money drives them away. So my question is, you've experienced this, you've seen it on a grand scale. Now you're coming back to lead a company in Birmingham, Alabama. What is your takeaway? And you're welcome to disagree with me, but what is your takeaway around that concept of, man, I got to get back into my routine. Mm-hmm. I've got to, get my accountability group, my small group, get plugged back into my church.
Yeah.
I know your wife got a job with the adoption agency here. And so y'all are connected and adopting and all of that. Is that the platform now that you can go out and create what you want to do with Telegraph? Just talk to me about that concept.
Well, I think you're so spot on with this. And actually, even before I went to the White House, I think it may have been 2014, 2015, I actually had a revelation as a part of an exercise where I was trying to think of what my New Year's resolutions would be. And so I started doing a lot of research on New Year's resolutions and why they'd never stick and this kind of thing. And there are a lot of different reasons for that that I won't dive off into here. But one of the main ones was people don't have a plan. They have like an aspiration, like, oh, I think I would like to get in shape, or I would like to. Yeah, that's a wish is probably a better way to put it. And that wish becomes a goal once you put it down on paper. And so I really think that planning is such an important part of what we're talking about. And so in 2014 or 15, I decided that I was going to try to – I wanted to seek – I wanted to pursue personal growth in three areas. And it was physically, mentally, and spiritually. And so I created a plan for how I was going to do that. When it was physically, Iron Tribe was a big part of that. And the community that Iron Tribe created around me to kind of support me in that was big. Mentally, I'm a huge believer in reading. And so I want to bite off kind of bite-sized goals, like things that you can actually accomplish. So like, I'm going to read a book a week for the whole year. Like, don't do that. let's take a little baby step here and get some small wins. But I started mapping out a reading plan, then things that would apply to my job that I could apply there to my faith, that I could apply there to my body, just different areas, things that I wanted to learn about and read just for fun, just, grow my mind. And then spiritually, this was the one where I felt like I needed to have the most accountability. And so what I did was I bit off leading a small group, because doggone it, on Tuesday night, they're going to be here and I've got to teach something. So I have no choice but to be ready for that and stay in the Word. And so that was kind of what I did. And when I got to the White House, Secretary Mattis, the Secretary of Defense at the time, an extraordinary man. I mean, he, as he kind of worked his way up in the military, he had a 7,000 volume library that he took with him to every station that he went.
Wow.
And I had read a lot about this. And so in some of these meetings before a foreign leader would come in and there was just some downtime, I would do everything I could to pick his brain. What are you reading right now? Or, I asked him one day, why did you do that? And he made an extraordinary point that is so obvious, but I just never considered. He said, as I approach a battlefield, I have people's lives in my hands. Literally, kids will live and die based on what I do. So obviously, I think life is precious and I want to take care of these as much as I can. And I owe it to them to know what Napoleon did in a similar situation, to know what Alexander the Great did in a similar situation, to know what Pershing did in a similar situation, to know how Eisenhower did this, that, or the other, so that I approach a battlefield, even though I've never been to this battlefield before, I know how this same scenario has played out in history, and I can apply that to what I'm doing on the battlefield. And he said he brought that 7,000 volume, books everywhere that he went with him. But he said the same thing, like every person that I met who had made it to that level and who was operating at the highest level with, and really getting results, all of them had a personal growth plan. James Mattis has a personal growth plan. What's this guy need to grow for? He's a four-star general. He's now the Secretary of Defense. He's literally never lost a battle, and yet he's still learning every single day. And that's the approach that I want to take to a Telegraph, that now as I approach business decisions, and we're kind of a disruptive company in technology, and we're trying to do disruptive things. And so learning about companies that have been successful in disruptive spaces and what are the pitfalls that I need to look out for, because you know what? Now I have 25 people that work for me whose lives depend on the decisions that I make. Maybe not literally life and death, but their ability to provide for their family, their ability for them to be fulfilled in this thing that they do for half of their waking hours. I mean, so much is at stake there. And it comes back to these people. And that was really Mattis's thing. It was like, I cared about my people. And I had to look myself in the mirror and say, do I love the people that work for me? Because if I do, then, and I have no choice but to put in the work to make sure that I've got a plan, that I'm growing, that I'm developing so that we can tackle whatever challenges come along. So that was kind of a roundabout way to get to that answer.
I love it, though. I mean, it's such a good point that leaders are readers. I mean, you just can't get away from it. You're growing or you're dying.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So in conclusion, you've been very gracious with your time. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Final question, and it's got to be on everybody's mind. Trump and next election, 2020, what is your prediction there?
Well, it's a little bit hard to predict because, you know, there are 20 Democrats running right now. And a lot of the way this is going to play out is going to be a function of who the Democrats choose. And right now they're at a point where their party seems to be kind of held hostage by the fringes. Socialists, literally socialists now. And if they put up a socialist up there, then Trump's just going to pulverize them, I think. What gets a little bit tougher, the two people that I think pose the greatest threat to Trump are, one, Joe Biden. He's a more blue-collar, working-class kind of Democrat. The Rust Belt Reagan Democrats that Trump was able to bring back over to the Republican Party on issues like trade. Biden appeals to those folks in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and Ohio. So he would have a chance to disrupt that path to victory that Trump had in 2016. The other one is Kamala Harris. And I don't think that she is as naturally talented a politician as Obama was, but I do think she's very talented, and also she could be another historic president because she'd be the first woman president. Obviously, she's African American, so she puts back together kind of that Obama coalition of African Americans that supported him so strongly, came out so strongly for him. Again, she could disrupt that Trump path that he's on right now. Outside of that, I'm not really impressed by a lot of the folks that I see. And even among that group, I don't think it's a particularly impressive group. And historically, no president has not won re-election with the economy roaring the way that it is right now going into the election. So I think that I give Trump a 60-40 chance, 65-35 chance maybe of being re-elected. But as with every other historical president, it blows up when Trump walks in the door. So it's really tough to predict.
It is. Okay, well, read the book, Team of Vipers, where books are sold. Cliff, how can we follow you and what you're doing now?
I'm on Twitter at Cliff_Sims, on Instagram at Cliff Sims. And would love for anybody out there that's listening that needs creative services or any kind of technology built for them, check out telegraphcreative.com. A really great company with really great people doing cool work, and we'd love to help anybody we can.
Awesome. Cliff, thank you for being on.
Thank you for having me.